ctsurvey.com. This is New Hampshire Public Radio.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire's nickname, the Granite State, conjures images of a kind of rough-hewn New England resilience, but there's an unfortunate geological reality to that name as well, a band of bedrock that makes the region one of about a dozen hotspots in the country for arsenic in drinking wells. In fact, a recent report by the U.S. Geological Survey found about 50,000 New Hampshire residents may be drinking water from wells with arsenic concentrations exceeding health standards. And there were other worrisome metals found as well. All in all, heightening concerns for the roughly 50% of Granite Staters who rely on private wells. Still, the remaining half who get their water from public supplies aren't off the hook, served by systems that struggle with aging infrastructure and are vulnerable to other types of contamination. Today in The Exchange, water worries and solutions. Let's hear from you. What challenges do the water supply in your city or town face? What remedies do you think would help? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. We have three guests in studio. Joe Ayotte is here, hydrologist at the U.S. Geological Survey. And Joe, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Good to be here.
Also with us, Sarah Pillsbury. She runs the Public Drinking Water Program at New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. And Sarah, welcome back to you, too.
Thanks.
And Sam Evans-Brown is also with us, NHPR's environment reporter. He's been following that arsenic story that I mentioned. And Sam, thanks for carving time out for us. We appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
Well, Sam, I want to start with you. Can we generalize about the issues facing New Hampshire drinking water as a state, or are water quality issues kind of like real estate, you know, location, location, location?
Yeah, it's definitely the latter. In fact, you can get to the point with bedrock wells where, you know, we've got one neighbor drilling a well who's got one problem, and then one door down, another well is drilled, and they've got entirely different problems. It just depends what rock you hit. But, you know, broadly, in broad strokes, there's basically two sources of water in New Hampshire. You've got surface water and groundwater, and the problems tend to, you can sort of segregate them by those two categories. Surface water contaminants are things more like bacteria, nitrates, and nitrites. Stuff from plants and animals that get in the water that you can't drink because it makes you sick.
Runoff, yeah.
Well, yeah, broadly. But then you've got groundwater contaminants, which tend to be minerals and things like that the water has been soaking in, that when you pull the water up, come along for the ride.
Interesting. And so surface water, groundwater, there's another way to look at this too, right, Sam? X percent of New Hampshire residents get their water from public water supplies, reservoirs and so forth, and X percent get it from these private wells.
Right. And when you go the public-private distinction, there's public water drinking wells that are basically just big wells, and then there's public water systems that are off of surface water, and same thing for private wells. You've got private wells that are dug wells that are really just capturing the top water coming from the top layer, and then other that are bedrock wells that have been filtered down through many layers of sand and rock and gravel, et cetera.
And brand new numbers from Department of Environmental Services show about half of New Hampshire residents get their water from private wells, about half from public resources. I'd love your thoughts too, Joe Ayotte, on this location, location, location idea. It seems to me when I look at the map of New Hampshire that each individual town or region has its own water quality challenges.
That's absolutely true. Most of the contaminants that we see in groundwater, especially for private wells, comes from the minerals that are part of the rocks that the water flows through. And in particular, one group of rocks may be very well known for having high arsenic in groundwater. Another group may be related to uranium. There's rocks up in the North Conway area that are famous for delivering fluoride to the water systems.
Wow. So depending on where you look and depending what rock is beneath you, you've got a different water quality challenge.
Yeah, definitely.
So arsenic, radon, lead. What was the other one you mentioned?
We looked at arsenic, manganese, lead, and uranium in this most recent study.
And why are those harmful?
Well, they all have various toxicological effects on the body, which is why we're concerned about them. They have human health benchmarks for which we don't want to exceed. And and we'd like to keep them below that level so that we ensure safety through our drinking water.
And these come up, again, these are from the rock. So in a way, you could say it's a Mother Nature-produced problem, right, Joe?
It most likely is. All the evidence that we have so far suggests that these contaminants come from the minerals in the rocks and not from some anthropogenic source.
Yeah, I'd like your thoughts too, Sarah, on this idea of no matter where you are in New Hampshire, the water problems and issues are different.
They certainly are different. And, you know, you had talked about, you lead it off with the concept of water worries, and there are a lot of challenges in terms of drinking water in New Hampshire. But if you sort of step back from that, and I'm a glass half full kind of gal, really, if you're on public water systems, your water's being tested and you're not allowed to exceed any standards. If you look at the studies that the most recent one that just came out, or, you know, the ones before that, certainly there is an incidence. They talk about 20% of the wells in New Hampshire exceeding the arsenic standard. But the majority of private wells are perfectly fine and people are getting great water. The trick with private wells is to test them, because you can't say, my neighbor has good water, as Sam suggested. My neighbor has good water, so I have good water. You need to test your well. If you have an issue, treatment's not a big deal. So everybody, and like lots of places in the world, everybody in New Hampshire has access to safe and reliable drinking water.
Well, and I definitely want to ask all of you about the testing and so forth and fixing if you find a problem. But you said something, Sarah, that piqued my interest, talking about water worries. You said, don't worry too much. You know, the water is plentiful, obviously, and generally of good quality. How much of your work, Sarah, is affected by the general public just taking water for granted? You know, you turn the tap on, there it is.
I think, in two areas that's really true. The first area is that private homeowner with a private well. We really encourage them to test that well, and so many people don't do that and don't do it for a variety of different reasons.
Well,
that
it
are
looks
actually
good.
Being
it doesn't
studied.
Smell. So
right. There, it's odorless. You don't see it for a lot of the contaminants, and so that's been an ongoing challenge of just test your well, test it. Whatever's in it, we can treat it, we can fix it, but find out what it is that you and your family are drinking. And then the other piece is the infrastructure piece, where these systems have been in place for a really long time. And because people have this good, reliable water every time they turn on their tap, they don't think about the need to do the investment required to keep that water flowing to their tap.
Yeah, it's easy to just turn it on. There it is. So you're a victim of your own success in a way.
In a way, yes. Yeah. Yeah. And water is so taking, oftentimes when I go out and talk to people, I always start it, the conversation with, did you have a shower this morning? Did you have some coffee? you plan to go swimming later kind of thing. Because once people start thinking about it, everybody values water in for different reasons, of course, but everybody values water. So translating that into these public built water systems.
All right. Let me invite our listeners to join us. And then a lot more questions, especially about this recent report on arsenic. I know that's been concerning for a lot of folks. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in the exchange, we're looking at water worries and lots of solutions to those worries. Let's hear from you. What challenges do you see the water supply in your town or city facing? What remedies do you think might help improve that supply? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We're taking your questions and comments about New Hampshire's water at 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like, NHPR Exchange, all one word. So, Sam Evans Brown, getting to the reports that you did based on Joe's work about arsenic in the drinking wells, just remind us, what was the big takeaway from that report, Sam?
Well, basically that there's a lot of people. I mean, we've already hit some of the themes here, that there are a lot of people at risk, that testing needs to be done so that you can know what you have, and that once you get tested, treatment is pretty straightforward. But also, what got me started on the report I got started on reporting this months before Joe's report came out, and it just happened to be very good timing that he was updating his study that he had done 10 years ago right now. But I got started because of a study that was being done by Columbia University in the state of Maine. Well, it was actually supposed to be Maine and New Hampshire, but New Hampshire residents had very low responding rates, so they ended up just doing it in Maine. On the effects of arsenic consumption at very low levels, even levels below the safe EPA limit, on childhood IQ. And so, you know, that came out just a few months ago. That's they were reproducing a study that was done in Bangladesh. And the result was that, you know, even at levels, you know, so the EPA limit is 10 parts per billion in your water. At 5 parts per billion and up, they were already seeing impacts on IQ, 5 to 10 points.
Really?
Loss at an IQ test.
And 5 is much, you know, it's half of the allowable standard.
Exactly. So, and you know, I've seen this before, and I've done arsenic stories in the past in which I've talked to a DES employee, for instance, who had found that she had arsenic in their well water. They had a whole house treatment system installed, and then they were testing the water coming out of the whole house treatment system and finding it still had, I think they said 8 parts per billion, so it was below the EPA limit. But knowing what she knew about arsenic, she put in an under-the-sink filter as well so that it would get down below 2 parts per billion. So, you know, there's an EPA limit. It's safe that they have determined is safe, but, you know, you might want to take a look at the science about what's coming out right now.
Wow, and that DES employee, of course, knew that even 8 was still worrisome, even though it was under the acceptable limit, but most folks wouldn't know that. They would
right.
say, cool, I'm under the EPA limit.
Right, and so that's. I mean, it's very tough for EPA to set these limits. Oftentimes, it's political. I mean, we've seen this with radon in the past, where EPA put out a limit on radon that would have, you know, it was like 90-some-odd percent of New Hampshire wells would have had above the allowable limit, and so there was so much pushback on that that the standard was shelved, and right now we have no EPA limit on radon. So I would say if I were a homeowner and there was any contaminant found in my well water, I would do a lot of research myself to find out what the science actually is that is backing up that limit.
How expensive was it for that person that you mentioned, Sam, to make all these improvements? Are we talking hundreds or thousands?
We're talking thousands. I mean, it was a little while ago, so I don't know the exact number, but the whole house treatment system runs on something of the order of $3,000,
$2,000. Wow.
Depending on exactly what kind of system you get. An under-the-sink filter, though, is much less expensive. We're talking the hundreds.
Yeah, you can get that at some sort of a home goods store or something like that.
Probably.
I'm assuming. All right. Well, we will start taking your calls after a short break. So join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We want your questions, comments, thoughts about your drinking water on The Exchange. Stay with us.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. The Exchange is coming to the North Country. You're invited to join Laura Kanoy and a panel of experts as they discuss the state of the Main Street economies north of the Notches. You can attend the special event at the Colonial Theater in Bethlehem, July 10th. Reserve your tickets at nhpr.org. Partly to mostly cloudy today, with widespread showers and thunderstorms this afternoon. Some thunderstorms may produce some gusty winds and heavy rainfall. Highs mid-70s in the North Country, 80s for the rest of the state. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare, a sustainable system improving the health of our communities for generations to come. Imagine.d-h.org. And from the Country Carriage on Meredith Bay, celebrating its 30th anniversary at Mill Falls Marketplace, Saturday, June 28th, noon to 4. Festivities and refreshments, countrycarriage.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're taking another look at New Hampshire's drinking water, both public water supplies and on private wells, especially given new research about arsenic that may be present in larger amounts than we had thought in New Hampshire's private wells. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. That's NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Joe Ayotte, hydrologist at the U.S. Geological Survey, Sam Evans-Brown, NHPR's environment reporter, and Sarah Pillsbury. She runs the Public Drinking Water Program at New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. Before we go to our listeners, Joe Ayotte, I did want to give you a chance to jump in on some of the things that Sam was telling us just before the break, that this arsenic study was pretty disturbing for folks and that it may or may not be cheap to fix it.
Right. As Sam pointed out, a lot of those public health studies really point to concerns about consuming water with these types of contaminants in them. And Sarah Flanagan, the lead author of the study that we just put out, noted that, you know, even though the percentages of wells affected is relatively small and not that alarming, it still translates to over 80,000 people in southeast New Hampshire, which is a lot of people.
That is a lot of people.
And, you know, if there's a public health issue, it really behooves people to think a little bit about testing and possibly treatment to bring those levels down.
And what sorts of reaction have you gotten at your office since this came out?
Well, it's, you know, some of it was stuff that we expected. We expected the arsenic levels to be high, and we'd seen that in the past and with other studies. Uranium, we didn't know much about, and we do see that there are very high levels, especially associated with some of the granites. The arsenic tends to be associated with non-granites, with rocks derived from ocean sediment. Probably the biggest surprise, though, was the amount of lead we found in these drinking water supplies. I mean, we don't really know where it's coming from. It's probably, some of it's probably geologic, but some of it's probably part of the plumbing system.
Are you hearing a lot of concern from folks saying, you know, tell me more, help me out?
It's relatively newly released, so we haven't heard a whole lot yet, but I expect we'll be hearing more about it in the future.
I bet you're hearing from people, too, Sarah, again, as head of New Hampshire's drinking water program.
Sure. Yeah, our phones have been ringing off the hook with people either wanting to know how they go about getting a bottle to test, or they've had the test done and what should they. A lot of people get very overwhelmed. They go out and look at for treatment, and they get the, you know, different ideas from many different vendors, and then get really overwhelmed on what they should choose for treatment. One of the things that we're doing and should be available within the next year is to try and come up with an app where somebody can put in their specific water quality results, and it will explain what are appropriate treatments given that. What's the appropriate treatment train? Because usually you don't have just one thing. You have arsenic and you have iron and maybe you have manganese and sometimes throw in some radon. So what are the pieces I have to put together to, in the end, have good water come out the tap?
It's so surprising because if you look at New Hampshire, it's such a clean, largely, you know, beautiful state, lots of trees, lots of clean, fresh water. So it's hard to imagine that the water that's coming up from the ground has all this stuff in it. Again, naturally occurring in the rock, as Joe explained. It's probably hard for people to wrap their heads around that.
Yeah, I think that it can be hard. And particularly, you can't taste it, you can't see it. But it's true.
Let's hear from our listeners. Lots of folks who want to jump in our conversation. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Let's go to Freedom First. Jerry's on the air. Hi, Jerry. Thanks for waiting. You're on the exchange.
Yes. Hi. My name's Jerry, and I'm the chair of the Board of Trustees of the Green Mountain Conservation Group. And it's a small nonprofit organization in the Ossipee Lake area that's dedicated to protection of the Ossipee Aquifer through a combination of research and education and advocacy and land conservation. And as opposed to the mineral contamination, a lot of our focus is on surface contamination, which is usually an impact from people. And it is, I always do find it rather amazing how many people think that their activities on their own land won't really affect other people. But we know that contamination in an aquifer, such as this Ossipee Aquifer, a very large stratified drift aquifer, could affect thousands of people within that aquifer and downstream all the way into Saco, Maine.
And Jerry, hang on one sec. Just explain to folks what an aquifer is, because some people might not know quite what
that
is.
Sure. An aquifer basically is, if you can think of it sort of as a water basin, there's the surface water that one can see. That's your lake. But the Ossipee Aquifer, for example, there's a very large collection of basically sort of glacial till that got dumped of rocks and sand and so on that is that encompasses a large area of a number of towns, Tamworth and Freedom and Madison and Effingham and Ossipee. And the water flows through that underground in addition to flowing through on the surface. So we see water that we might dump into the lake, and we know that that travels all the way down through a number of bays and down through the river all the way down to Saco, Maine.
So,
but
Jerry,
the water
what are
travels
you seeing,
underground as
yeah,
well.
What are you seeing people do? I'm interested in what you said about, you know, people don't realize that their activities affect their drinking water. I'd love to hear just some examples of what you see folks doing.
Well, a couple of things we have to think about. For example, even as simple things such as salt contamination. If you're over-salting your roads, there's going to be runoff. Fertilizers, for example, if we have somebody who lives near the lake and they fertilize a lawn heavily, that phosphorus will run off into the lake. one can do a number of remediations for this. I mean, a buffer zone of vegetation can help to trap some of those things so they don't flow straight into the lake. The dumping of gasoline or leaky gasoline tanks, and anything like that, can really be a problem that will get into the aquifer. And if you just dump something up in Tamworth in your aquifer, it'll show up in the river going down toward Maine later on. And
okay.
If it's a large amount, it could be a problem.
Jerry, this is a great point, and there's a couple things I want to follow up on. So thank you so much. Sam, go ahead. You want to jump in, and then I have another question for Sarah. Yeah.
Yeah, I just want to highlight this sort of shows the various challenges that affect various sources. I mean, and so there are a lot of large population centers in New Hampshire that are served by public drinking water systems that come from the same kind of water that Jerry's talking about. I mean, not necessarily a stratified drift aquifer, but for instance, you have surface water in Concord and Manchester, for instance.
Big lakes.
Right. And the way that the drinking water authorities are trying to protect those is they buy up the land around those lakes. They keep people from swimming in them, from boating in them. And so that's sort of the strategy to protect drinking water, to keep it clean, so you have to do minimal treatment later on. So this just sort of highlights the two strategies that you have to go to get clean water.
So one strategy, again, the Concord model or Manchester model, where you have it all protected, plenty of buffers, so that does soak up some of the runoff problems that our caller mentions. But are there other, I'll ask you maybe this, Sarah, are there other surface water sources, again, big lakes or reservoirs, where, like Lake Ossipee, there's plenty of swimming and boating and fishing and all sorts of activity on Lake Ossipee?
There are, and the places like Concord and Manchester, that was some very smart men and women 100 years ago thinking about protecting this resource for the long term. So that, being able to purchase those really big chunks of land and putting that protection in place, and then throughout time, and the people operating these water systems deserve a lot of credit keeping that in place. And now there's a lot of scientific data showing how much that helps in terms of not having to do certain treatment, because you do have those big tracts of forested land in place. There are other places in New Hampshire. Laconia is one that comes to mind, where their intake is right in Paugus Bay. But that, that's where it was, and development pressures continued around Paugus Bay.
That's part of Wenpesaugi, right?
Yes.
That's so heavily used.
Heavily used. And so they don't have the luxury of the natural protection. When you think about drinking water, there's this multi-barrier approach where, in the ideal world, you would protect the source, then you would do whatever treatment that is needed, then you'd store it and distribute it properly, and then the final piece is testing every once in a while and keeping people aware of their water supply and what's in their water supply. The luxury of the source protection, and I source protection was kind of my baby for many, many years, dear to my heart. It is somewhat of a luxury to get that land protected around a source. But again, the science is just strong and keeps coming how important that piece of it can be.
Okay, so this brings up kind of a political question, Sarah. The Shoreland Protection Act passed, in its first iteration, maybe 15 years ago, I think, that required landowners on a lake, whether it's a water, drinking water supply or not, to have certain buffer zones, as our caller says, bushes, trees. Don't use as much fertilizer. We all love that big green lawn right down to the lakeside, but it's not good for water quality. But we've kind of gone back and forth on this Shoreland Protection Act, haven't we? Kind of changing it over the years, loosening it, tightening it, back and forth.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. So many of our environmental issues now come down to it's us, it's the landowner, it's individuals making choices. It's not going after, one large corporation or one big landowner. It's really all of us and the choices that we're making. So the shoreline protection, they've really gone back and forth trying to find the balance. Clearly, what
between
they have
between property rights and water protection.
In water protection, but clearly, what has been put into place is protecting surface water quality. And if that surface water is being used for drinking water, it's protecting drinking water too.
Joe Ayotte, you want to jump in there?
Not so much on that topic, but another thing the caller mentioned, and we've talked about how a lot of these contaminants come from geologic sources. They're natural. But it's worth making the distinction that the different aquifer types, the stratified drift, as the caller mentioned, in Ossipee versus the bedrock aquifer, that we use frequently for private domestic wells have different kinds of contaminants. Some of the work that our National Water Quality Assessment Program has done has shown recently that chloride, for example, is increasing nationwide, especially in the northern tier where road salting is common. And that's absolutely happening in the Northeast and in New Hampshire as well.
So that's not Mother Nature.
That is not Mother Nature. But other contaminants that differ, whereas we see arsenic in the bedrock well system, we tend to see things like manganese and uranium more in the stratified drift aquifers.
Another non-Mother Nature, if I could call it that, source of contamination is MTBE. It was a gasoline additive, again, 15 or so years ago, supposed to make air pollution better, but then some of it leaked into the ground. And that's something else we see, right, Joe?
It is. We had done work almost 10 years ago now that identified large amounts of MTBE in wells widespread across the state, but in particular in the counties that used MTBE in the gasoline, the southeastern four counties. And it's been 10 years. There's a lot that's happened since then. The state is gearing up, as Sarah could tell you, to do more testing on that. And hopefully, we're going to look at how things have changed over that 10-year period by resampling some wells.
Okay. I know you want to jump into Sam on Jerry, our caller, shoreland protection, and, you know, the role that that has played in keeping drinking water clean.
Yeah, I was just going to say the Shoreland Protection Act, that it was sort of it was seen by some homeowners groups as being too strict. It was sort of pruned, and then the sort of a middle ground was found this past, or not this year in the session, but the previous year. But a lot of individual towns have been enacting or thinking about enacting in their own ordinances the original Shoreland Protection Act. A lot
the
of these
tougher
lake,
version.
Yeah, a lot of these lake towns, Wolfboro, Meredith, that see water quality as sort of an economic driver for them because that's why people come to their towns. So it is an interesting dynamic. We won't dwell on it too long because it's not exactly what we're talking about. The other thing I wanted to mention, the MTBE, of course, is that the state won the largest settlement in its history on the MTBE case, but that money's probably going to be locked up for a very long time because ExxonMobil is a very aggressive litigant, and they're going to do everything they can to keep the state from getting the money just to deter future suits from other states.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you again, Jerry, for that call. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. We want your questions, comments, concerns about your drinking water in New Hampshire. Let's go next to Deering. Chris is on the air. Chris, thanks for waiting. You're on the Exchange. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Laura.
Sure.
Good morning. Just for full disclosure, this is Chris Wells from the Society for the Protection of New Hampshire Forest. Good morning. Hi, Sarah, in particular. I just wanted to pick up a little bit more on the thread around the source water protection issue. This is something that Sarah's very well aware of, but it's worth mentioning. Getting back to the public drinking water supply side, you also have several hundreds of thousands of folks that are being served by essentially well-supplied public water supplies. DES has actually done a lot of good work over the years defining what they call, quote, wellhead protection areas around all those wells. Essentially, it's the same idea that Sarah was talking about earlier with the surface water systems, where they're essentially meant to be an undeveloped, typically forested buffer through which then water is passing as it perks down into the ground to feed those wells and is being essentially naturally filtered. Conversely, if those lands are developed, you're potentially at least creating the potential for contaminants to get into those well systems. So the number I was just going to kind of put out there for folks to think about and talk about is, as of now, only roughly 10% of all of those wellhead protection areas around the state, which are heavily concentrated in the southeast, are actually in permanent conservation. So the other 90% of that land base that are directly surrounding and buffering these public water supply wells are actually permanently conserved. And I guess the only other thing I was going to add, too, and again, this is something that Sarah as well knows very much about, is a few years ago, the state of New Hampshire did have a modest funding program that was the Drinking Water Land Protection Program, which is actually still on the books but has not been funded for a number of years now. So one fairly small thing we could do on the policy side is say, should we take a look at getting some funding back into that program?
Okay, Chris, thank you for calling in. Sarah, boy, he raises a lot of same issues that our other caller raises, buffer zones, protecting these public water drinking supplies in whatever way we can. What about the state's role, though? I'm interested in this in terms of helping communities protect their water supplies, improve their water supplies. It seems in New Hampshire that a lot of this is a local responsibility. What is the state's responsibility?
In terms of protecting their sources of drinking water, I mean, we've had an active, it began as a wellhead protection program, morphed into a drinking water source protection program to include of surface waters too, of course, just as important. And we did have a grant program for a number of years that was focused. It was a 50% matching grant program. We protected a lot. Close to 4,000 acres of land that were around these wells and sources of drinking water. I mean, we continue to work with towns. We continue to provide technical assistance.
Expertise.
But there is not a funding source to actually acquire the lands, which is what Chris was speaking to. And you know, if you look at all the wells in the state that have been taken offline because of, you know, MTB or other natural or man-made contaminants, or have had to put on very expensive treatment because of that, that could have been avoided if, in fact, you could have protected the area that the water's coming from.
All right. Well, it's a good point. Thank you, Chris. And let's go next to Mary in Bedford. Hi, Mary. You're on the Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks very much for having taking my call.
Sure.
I'm wondering, we had our water in Bedford tested. We use a well tested 20 years ago, and everything was fine. And I've sort of just gone along thinking everything continues to be fine. Is there any need to retest?
To retest after how long ago was it, Mary?
20 years ago.
20 years ago.
You know, are there more sophisticated tests now that we should be using?
Yeah, probably. It's a good question. Sarah and then Joe, you want to go first Sarah?
Quickly, I'll say that the recommendation out of the department is to test your wells every 3 to 5 years. If you're in an area that's being rapidly developed, or if there's some specific source of a contaminant, you know, a gas station next door, you may want to step that up. You may want to do that once every year. Or if you have a dug well where it's not quite as sealed up as a drilled well might be, you might want to test more frequently. But definitely more than once every 20 years.
20 years seems like a long time. What do you think, Joe?
And we see changes over time.
Yeah, those recommendations are sound. And in fact, a lot of things change. The reporting limits that the states can detect down to get lower all of the time and other labs. And that's important because you may have had no contaminant at one time. Maybe for arsenic it was 10, but now that they're down to 1 or less, suddenly you see that you have it.
Well, and as Sam explained earlier, the science is evolving, so we know more than we did 20 years ago. Mary, thanks. I hope that helps. You can join us, too, with your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. More on New Hampshire's drinking water in just a moment.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, analysis of primary election results in 7 states, including 2 runoffs. Then, this month's Reader's Review, the best-selling young adult novel, The Fault in Our Stars by John Green. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. New Hampshire weather partly to mostly cloudy today with some widespread showers and thunderstorms this afternoon. Some thunderstorms could produce some gusty winds and heavy rainfall. Today's highs mid-70s for the North Country, 80s in the rest of the state. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from HealthSouth Rehabilitation Hospital in Concord, helping individuals return to active independent lives through comprehensive medical rehabilitation services. HealthSouthConcord.com. And Granite Steak Candy Shop in Concord in Manchester, makers of gourmet chocolates, fine confections, and super premium ice cream since 1927, nhchocolates.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, our earlier conversation on Greek life on college campuses and where it stands today. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. Today on The Exchange, we're putting New Hampshire's drinking water under the microscope, and you can join us with your thoughts, comments, questions, concerns about the drinking water in your town. 1-800-892-6477 is our number, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. You can also continue the conversation on Facebook. Before we go back to our listeners, all of you, Sam Evans-Brown, we had a caller just before the break who said she'd gotten her water tested 20 years ago. Both Sarah Pillsbury and Joe Ayotte said, you probably want to get it tested again. Things are always changing. You had some thoughts on that as well.
Right. Just a real quick point. In 2001, since we're talking about arsenic so much this hour, the standard on arsenic was dropped from 50 parts per billion down to 10 parts per billion as what's considered safe. So if she had her well tested before that standard was dropped, she might have had a result that's in, the 30s or the 40s that she was told was safe, that new science has shown, might not be safe. So this just gets back to, if you're having your well tested periodically, it's going to reconnect you with water professionals who understand the safety risks, and it's going to keep you updated on the science that's evolving.
A new homeowner, and I remember when I bought my first house, sometimes you just don't know this stuff. It's so overwhelming. How much does it cost? And the mortgage and the interest rates and the property taxes and the neighbors and, are there termites? There's so much for a new homeowner to think about. Sam, who's educating, especially first-time homebuyers, about well water?
Right. So there's a big push-pull here, obviously. So there's the disclosure form that the state requires say certain things about, whatever. There's lots of things that are required on the real estate disclosure form that a realtor hands to a homeowner. But what goes on that form is a political process. And we saw the last iteration of this session where you had the DES asking for sort of a radon disclosure and an arsenic disclosure. You had the New Hampshire Association of Realtors coming back and saying, we think that the language is just too strong and we don't want to scare people who, for instance, it said 1 in 5 wells in certain parts of the state may have high levels of arsenic. And they said, it's really only certain parts of the state. Why are we going to give this to someone in Littleton who doesn't have that same risk? And so they had that taken off, and then the whole thing was scrapped sort of in the Committee of Conference negotiating session. So it's tough. It's a political process. The realtors don't want people to be scared. The well drillers feel like they're getting beaten up on because of all these contaminants, and so they push back.
Sarah, what do you think? Do other states require homeowners be notified about some of these natural contaminants? Again, Joe keeps telling us a lot of this stuff is from Mother Nature. It comes from the rock, but there it is. Do other states require realtors and others to tell people about these risks?
Yeah, it varies across the country. There are actually some states, New Jersey comes to mind, when property changes hands, it requires a test. And they got that through under the understanding that it's, an $85 test is a very small percentage of the kind of funds that you're putting towards a new home. And if you don't know about it, you can be stuck with a much higher bill depending on what contaminants you have. So there are states that actually require testing. In terms of disclosure, that varies from state to state. As a department, we would like to see more disclosure around radon and arsenic. Hopefully we at some point can see eye to eye with the realtors in terms of what would be appropriate language to give people a heads up that this is really something they want to think about on the front end before buying a home.
All right, let's take some more calls. George is waiting in Amherst. Hi, George. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had two questions. I wonder if your panel could talk a little bit more about the unique aspect of radon contamination. I lived in Derry in the 80s and 90s, and it's a big issue over there in that it actually, is dispersed into the atmosphere when the water is atomized, like in a shower. And the second question is, are there any maps or results of testing that show locally what I can expect to find if I key in an address? I live in Amherst now, and I'd like to just see what's been found around my home.
It's a great question, George, and you're right. It's all about where you are. Go ahead, Joe Ayotte. This is up your alley.
Sure, yeah. With respect to radon, radon is almost everywhere in the state and at fairly high levels, and it's actually unusual when it's low.
It's related to the granite, right?
Turns out it's higher in granites, but it's still pretty high in all the other rocks that
okay.
we have. So that's number one. In terms of maps of what's going on, a colleague of mine, Sarah Flanagan, recently published a report probably 2 years ago now showing the distribution of all kinds of contaminants across New England. So we have maps of radon. There's maps of iron and manganese. arsenic, uranium, a whole host of contaminants. And those kind of maps can be used by someone like George to see where the risks are and where they aren't.
Now, you don't have the maps in front of you, but any idea, roughly, he's in Amherst, so what some of the challenges might be that he would be facing in his rocks? I'm putting you on the spot here.
I would have to look at the maps.
Sure.
Amherst, certainly arsenic, potentially uranium, radon, definitely.
Well, the beauty of the internet is we can put some of those maps that you folks have done at U.S. Geological Survey on our website. We can put a link, nhpr.org. So thank you, George, for the call. Sam?
I just wanted to, you know, radon is, you know, we've been talking about arsenic a lot because that's sort of the thing that people want to get the word out. It's the new contaminant. But radon, you know, I think it was estimated that 1/3 of New Hampshire homes might have high radon. So that's even higher than arsenic. And it's tricky because it's in water, it's also very expensive to get out because you have to aerate the water, basically. And so you're bringing the water up from whatever source. You're bubbling it. They have sort of a bubbler, basically, that it runs through that lets the radon off gas, and it's pumped out of the house. And then you've got to repressurize your house water. So it's one of the more expensive ones to treat.
Yeah, I think we had that in our first house, and it was kind of surprising. Wow, radon. It sounded really scary.
It's really quite an operation.
Yeah. All right. Thanks again for that call. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And again, we'll put the maps on our website, on Facebook, so that people can take a look at what some of the bedrock issues might be in their area. 1-800-892-6477, again, is our number. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Let's go next to Kittery, Maine, where Chris is waiting. Hi, Chris. You're on the Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Hi, panel.
Hi.
Thanks, Tim McCall. Just a couple of very brief questions for you. As with a lot of other minerals, we find them naturally occurring in our bodies. And I'm sure arsenic is one of them. Is this a potentially, has the rate or the increase, has it happened recently? Also, one of the other questions, does it affect the flora and fauna of the region with these minerals naturally occurring? Get into the water supply, rivers, etc., the oceans. Do we see like salmon with three eyes and things like that?
You know, yeah, what I mean? I do. Like, yeah, it's actually something I hadn't thought about. Joe?
Well, there's one plant that is famous for processing arsenic is bracken fern, which is also known as fiddleheads. And certainly it occurs at relatively high levels in those plants. And if you do eat a lot of those, it's certainly worth thinking about. The other one that's big in the news lately is rice.
Which we don't really grow in New Hampshire, but
no,
still.
No, but it's certainly the rice we import and the rice we eat.
Yeah, you and I talked about this a couple months ago, Joe, I think, where
right.
You told us that rice in particular has that incredible ability to suck up and love arsenic, which is not good for us.
I just wanted to, so two quick notes to sort of answer Chris's question directly. It's not new. I think what's new is the sciences of our understanding of the impact on our health. And a quick note on bracken fern. Bracken fern is commonly consumed in Japan, and there's very high incidence of throat cancer there that's actually connected to that. But we, fiddleheads, if you go to the store here, most of the fiddleheads we have are ostrich ferns, which I am told do not have the same ability to take up arsenic.
All right, Chris, thanks again for the question. You know, Sarah Pillsbury, something you touched on very quickly earlier, but we should talk about a little bit more, is infrastructure. I mean, we can do everything right at the source. We can protect that reservoir. We can forbid people to swim and boat and so forth. Like in Concord, you know, the reservoir is pristine. You can't touch it. But then it goes through some pipes and gets to my house, and sometimes those pipes are 100 years old. Talk about some of the infrastructure challenges that New Hampshire cities and towns face.
Sure. So infrastructure is a hot topic right
now. So boring, but so important.
Yeah, yeah. It, out of sight, out of mind kind of thing, because all these pipes are buried under the roads that we drive along, and unless there is a big sinkhole and your car is stuck in it and there's water gushing out around you, you can pretty well ignore the idea of there may be work that's needed. But, you know, many of these systems, particularly the Concords and the Manchester, hundreds of years old,
Hundreds, more than 100.
More than 100
really?
Years old. And there are places in New Hampshire where the pipe in the ground is more than 100 years old still. So there's, you know, plenty to do in terms of just operating a water system and the costs involved with that. And then there's all this infrastructure that needs to be replaced and upgraded. And for a municipal water system, so in the drinking water realm, the estimate is $85 million over the next 10 years.
For New Hampshire as a whole?
New Hampshire as a whole. But if you take that number and then think about wastewater, stormwater, and dams, which a lot of the municipalities own dams as well, you get up to a figure of, you know, somewhere approaching $3 billion needed over the next 10 years to be invested in infrastructure just to keep it as good as it is today. So infrastructure is a big issue that I think everybody's going to be hearing a lot more about in the next few years.
Well, how do you make the case for that? Because as you said, it's under the ground. You don't see it. So how do you make the case that, look, this pipe is 120 years old and it's leaching some bad stuff into that nice clean water as it comes into your house?
Yeah, and breakage and whatnot. It's, you know, it's also for, I mean, I'm talking about municipal systems, but
sure.
Of the 700 community systems in New Hampshire, less than 100 meet that category. And the rest are, you know, less than 1,000 people. Half of them are serving less than 100 people. So the resources that they have to fix infrastructure are even less. But to make the case, it actually in New Hampshire, if you look at the track record, when a town actually says we just have to do this investment in our drinking water, everybody loves drinking water, and usually those votes will eventually pass. But it's a campaign each time, and so I think that's how you make the case, is just keep people thinking about how they're getting that water out of their tap.
Sam?
I was just going to say the state had a task force that they put together to look at this issue. They came out with a report that basically said a lot of the things that Sarah was just saying, and the chairman of that task force has been sort of making the rounds around the state trying to make this pitch. And it's actually kind of a story that I want to do, to just follow them around, because it is tough. I mean, like, no one's thinking about it. No one really wants to hear that they've got to invest $3 billion in something that they kind of took for granted. So, you know, it'd be fun to ask him how that's going.
Yeah, I think go ahead.
And when you think about the state's economy, I mean, there's a real case to be made that our water infrastructure is every bit as important as our roads. You could not have the city centers. You could not have the tourist-based economy. That infrastructure, we are totally reliant on in terms of New Hampshire's good economy.
Tough to fix, though, because you got to dig up roads often to fix the pipes, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
municipalities
disruptive.
Have been pretty good and DOT has been really very good at working with municipalities to try and coordinate that kind of thing.
Let's take one more call if we could. This is Jerry in Pembroke. Hi, excuse me, Jesse in Pembroke. Go ahead, Jesse. You're on the exchange.
Hi, Laura. Thanks. I was just curious. We talked a lot about the inadvertent poisoning of our drinking water and all of that, and the naturally occurring instances. But I was just curious to hear what your guests' thoughts were on the purpose of the intentional fluoridation of our drinking water in most municipal systems, especially in light of several mainstream studies from the likes of Harvard, et cetera, which indicate both the extreme toxicity of fluoride as well as it being ineffective in its claimed benefits of preventing tooth decay.
Wow, yeah, that's a big issue. Jesse, we could probably do a whole show on that, Sarah. I'm going to throw that to you just very quickly. He's right. Some municipal systems, but not all, correct me if I'm wrong, put fluoride in their water.
Correct. Municipalities need to have a municipal vote to decide to do that. I think if you talk to my counterparts in the Department of Health and Human Services, in the public health community in general, they will say this is one of the top 10 public health advances that we have made in America in terms of protecting dental health. So our role at the department is to make sure that the water systems that are putting it in are putting it in correctly.
Not too much.
But there's, almost every year in the legislature, this is talked about, debated, information is brought forward, and it continues in the municipalities that have chosen to try to tackle some tough dental health issues through this, you know, through this avenue.
Well, and going back to what we started talking about, which is the people on the private wells, again, about half of New Hampshire is on these private wells, and you've all raised some of the concerns that these well owners face. So, Joe Ayotte, let's say I'm on a private well. Where do I get started with this? I'm listening to the show and I'm thinking, shoot, what do I do?
Well,
and how do I not get taken in by, you know, too many services? I don't want to overspend on this.
Right. That's a good point. To follow up on the caller's comment about fluoride and natural versus man-made, the maps you referred to earlier that we were going to put up on the web certainly show, if you go to New Hampshire and you look at the fluoride map, there are places in North Conway where concentrations of fluoride are well above the MCL for fluoride and can actually cause dental fluorosis potentially. So knowing these kinds of things, if you're thinking of moving to that area or if you live in a certain part of the state, what am I likely to encounter? Going to these maps is a great first step.
And get tested. So how much should a test cost?
You know, that's really not my department. I guess I can pass that to Sarah.
Well, I can tell you the state charges $85 for their standard suite. That's sort of below market costs. If you go to a private tester, they charge more because the state sort of offers it as a service. But there are private testers as well. There's a little more than a dozen that can offer tests. And then as you add on beyond the private suite, things like uranium and things like that add additional costs, as well as testing for petroleum. And then once you're tested, they can recommend treatment at a private place that sells treatment systems.
All right.
DES.nh.gov. On the right-hand side, how do I test my water? Look at that webpage.
All right, great. And again, we'll put some of the maps that we talked about on our website as well, a link to what Joe and his colleagues have been doing, nhpr.org. All of you, thank you very much for being here. Joe Ayotte, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Laura.
Joe Ayotte, hydrologist at the U.S. Geological Survey. Sarah Pillsbury, good to see you. Thank you for being
Thanks.
Here. Sarah Pillsbury, she runs the public drinking water program at New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. Sam Evans-Brown, thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura.
Sam Evans-Brown, NHPR's environment reporter. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our intern is James Pouliot. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Canoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Canoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, our earlier conversation on grading Greek life on campus. For some students, it's a rite of passage to pledge to that fraternity or sorority for a sense of community and lifelong friendships. But after a series of recent ugly incidents, hazing, binge drinking, sexual assaults, colleges are looking harder at Greek organizations and whether some are getting out of control. We'll examine the big picture nationally and in New Hampshire. Join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show is next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where we get support from you, our listeners, and from the Wealth Management Group at Merrimack County Savings Bank. Trust and wealth management services provided by advisors committed to your financial needs. TheMerrimack.com. And Revision Energy, now offering Own Your Power loans for solar and other efficiency improvements. More at RevisionEnergy.com/OwnYourPower.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Katty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Seven states held primary elections yesterday. Two were runoffs. In a Mississippi runoff, veteran Republican Senator Thad Cochran held his seat against a Tea Party-backed state senator. In Oklahoma's primary, Republican Congressman James Lankford beat back a crowd of